From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the Ivory Tower bans free speech. Exiled students take Columbia University to court. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. A university is definitely not a democratic institution, quote unquote. So said Columbia University's Vice Dean of Graduate Studies, Herbert Dean, back in April 1967, at the height of campus protests against America's war on Vietnam. Quote, student or faculty opinion should not in itself have any influence on the formation of administrative policy, unquote, Dean declared in an interview with the university's student newspaper, The Daily Spectator. Quote, when decisions begin to be made democratically around here, I will not be here any longer, Dean warned darkly. Then, Dean Dean's famous throwaway line, quote, whether students vote yes or no on a given issue means as much to me as if they were to tell me they like strawberries, unquote. 60 years later, Herbert Dean's infamous strawberry statement continues to sum up Columbia University's indifference to and contempt for free speech. Last spring, amid rising campus protests against Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, university investment in the Zionist war machine, and sweetheart study deals for Israeli soldiers with blood on their hands, the Columbia University administration suspended four protest leaders, banned them from campus, forcibly evicted them from precious off-campus housing, and canceled their scholarships. Now, three of those students have struck back in a February 3rd filing to the Supreme Court of the state of New York. Counsel for Catherine Kern Groom, Brandon Murphy, and Aidan Parisi charged Columbia University with breach of New York State landlord, tenant, and human rights statutes, breach of contract, negligence, intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligent infliction of emotional distress, and willful misuse of its student conduct system to discriminate against, harass, endanger, and deny something called their Tadeshi rights. The GPM reached out to one of these three students, Catherine Curran Groom. At the time of her two-year suspension, back in early May 2024, Catherine Curran Groom was pursuing a master's degree in international affairs at Columbia's Morningside campus. Hello, Catherine Curran Groom. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hey, David. Good to be here.
And it's good to see you again, Catherine. Catherine, can you introduce yourself for those people who don't know who you are? Tell me a bit about yourself and how you became involved in Palestine solidarity to the extent that you feel you can talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So this last year have been most involved in Palestine solidarity organizing at Columbia University, where I was pursuing my master's of international affairs, specializing actually in Middle East and Arabic and specifically in Palestine studies there. But prior to Columbia, I have lived for the last about 7 years between the U.S. and Palestine. And in Palestine in particular, I've worked with a Palestinian community organization that does a lot of frontline work with communities facing the effects of ethnic cleansing and forced displacement by the Israeli military and settlement enterprise in the West Bank. And then prior to that, I really was drawn to Palestine organizing and studies in my undergrad, given my family's background. I'm part Lebanese, and I wanted to learn more about the history and the politics of the region and began to study it in undergrad. And, you know, once you start to pull those threads, everything kind of unravels about the American, not just misconceptions, but outright lies that we're intentionally miseducated with from the time we're in elementary school all the way up through our undergraduate and graduate school degrees. And so it was my undergraduate degree where I started seeking places outside of the classroom, outside of the university, to educate myself on Palestine. And that actually led me to go to Palestine for the first time, where I was an English teacher in refugee camps in Nablus and Balata camp when I was 19 years old.
And you mentioned, Catherine, the lies that you learned in school. Lies about Palestine or lies in general?
I would say in general, Palestine is not the sole target of American and Israeli propaganda. But I would say, by and large, especially growing up outside of New York City during the post 9/11 era, much of what we were taught about the American invasion and war on Iraq, on Afghanistan, the American complicity in the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the Iranian Revolution, so much of what has transpired in modern history in the region has been completely whitewashed and rewritten in American textbooks and in classrooms. And so it takes a lot of searching and connecting with the right people and the right sources to really unlearn a lot of the propaganda that we're taught in schools. And that was a process that I sadly didn't start until I was an undergraduate student myself.
And we're going to get into talking about your lawsuit against your litigation against Columbia University. For those who are listening, we're going to get into that. But, you know, talking about these lies, there's so much we could talk about, Catherine. I've just finished reading again Howard Zinn's great People's History of the United States, which I suspect you've read yourself. And having finished that, read that, I'm now reading the 1619 Project, which is fascinating. And I mean, I know a lot of this stuff kind of osmotically, you know. I'm an American, I know a bit about this history, but to read it in detail is really shakes you to the core what America is and has been from the beginning, from the 17th century, from like 150 years before it became the United States of America.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the kind of foundational relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and why so much of the propaganda that each state exports goes hand in hand between the American and Zionist entities, is that they both are settler colonial projects that seek to essentially continue this indoctrination of their own populations, but also populations globally, in order to whitewash their foundational genocides. Both Israel and the U.S. are founded upon genocide, and both of them continue to commit genocide to varying extents, degrees, and speeds today, but very much ongoing genocidal settler colonial projects. And I think that's one of the things that especially in America, we're most out of touch with, because people see it as a past sin and not an ongoing sin that we are all complicit in today, living on stolen land.
I refer to it as a single entity. I'm not sure who else refers to these two conjoined twins, thinks of them as conjoined twins as I do. I refer to it as Israel USA. It's the oldest, if you think about it, it's the oldest and the youngest settler colonial states to have emerged out of Europe, the United States and Israel. So it is, they are conjoined twins, aren't they? Would you disagree?
No, I would say that they have unique aspects to each of their projects, but that they are very much dependent and codependent on one another. I think Biden's quote that comes up sporadically of, if they're were no Israel, we would have to create one, I think speaks very clearly to the fact that America has always had a self-interest in Israel being its effective outpost in the Arab world, and that no matter what, America's imperialist goals would have led it to create an entity like Israel, if not exactly Israel, and that America essentially just took advantage in a really horrific way coming out of the Holocaust coming out of World War II, took advantage of what they saw as an opportunity to create an imperialist outpost in the Middle East and the Arab world, and that it actually had nothing to do with the so-called humanitarian goals or safety of the Jewish people. And I think that that has created this, as you call it, conjoined twin effect, but very much a codependency between one on the other.
You said, Catherine, that you were pursuing your master's degree at Columbia University. You are not anymore?
No, I only got through about 6 months of my master's degree before Columbia placed me on indefinite suspension, a process that they started using solely to target students organizing for Palestinian liberation, organizing for Columbia's divestment from the weapons manufacturers and Israeli companies that were making the bombs and sending the weapons that were dropping on Gaza and fueling the genocide. And so for those of us that spoke out too actively or were too central to the protest movement on campus, including the Gaza Solidarity encampments in Hinz Hall, Columbia essentially targeted a handful of us, believing that they could make an example out of us. And I ultimately was placed on a 2-year campus ban suspension and had my full scholarship revoked, which is worth over $100,000 and was the only way that I was able to attend and afford an institution like Columbia in the first place. So they have, to myself and my two co-plaintiffs on the lawsuit, but also about a dozen other students at Columbia and Barnard, are still facing these indefinite suspensions where many of us do not know if we will ever be able to return to Columbia. And in my case, I know I won't be able to return to Columbia unless Columbia is held accountable through this lawsuit and through public pressure to reverse its sanctions against me, because the university is wildly inaccessible to working class students. And so many of us rely on scholarships to study there. And then the university uses those scholarships as ways to retaliate against us if we speak out against their financial interests in the genocide.
So remind us, I mean, these protests took place on the Columbia University campus and Barnard campus, along with other American U.S. campuses back in April and May of last year, and there were tent encampments, and they eventually got busted up by the police, called in by the university under pressure from, you know, the government, the U.S. government. What was your own experience on the campus back last spring in front of what then was Hamilton Hall and has now been renamed Hinz Hall after Hind Rajab, the little 6-year-old girl who was gunned down by Israeli troops a year ago, almost a little more, over a year ago today. Recall for us those events of last spring.
Yeah. So actually the narrative goes, of course, like everything with Palestine goes much further back than just the Gaza Solidarity encampments. But my first kind of foray in the organizing scene on campus, I was elected the co-president of the Palestine Working Group at SIPA, which was the college at Columbia that I attended, the School of International and Public Affairs. So I was the co-president of a legitimate sanctioned student organization that has existed on campus for many years. That organization was part of a much broader coalition on campus called the Columbia University Apartheid Divest Coalition. This coalition had really popped off in its support, in its base, in the number of organizations that were claiming affiliation with it. At that time, over 100 organizations were part of the coalition. And this base of support was really a response to Columbia back in November of 2023, just a month into the genocide, deciding to ban Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace chapters on our campus. And this was one of the first examples since the genocide, but most definitely not the last, of Columbia making politically targeted retaliatory moves against students and student organizing on campus based on pressure from outside actors, including donors, Board of Trustee members, congressional committees, billionaires in a WhatsApp chat. There were numerous times over the last year and a half where Columbia has caved to, in particular, financial pressure from the outside. And in this case, it was a mega donor to Colombia who threatened to withdraw his donations if Colombia did not ban JVP and SJP. And so they did. And this was a pattern that we saw play out time and time again over the last year, where students were essentially disposed of and treated as disposable whenever it came to maintaining Colombia's bottom line, especially through its investments in the genocide in Israel. In January, there is a protest on campus, two Israeli soldier students attack a group of us who are protesting with a chemical agent known as skunk spray. Colombia has a program that recruits Israeli soldiers out of the army to come study at the School of General Studies. At the time, there were over 200 Israeli soldiers who were students on campus. Two of them dressed up wearing keffiyeh scarves, documented on video, infiltrate the crowd of the protest and spray a chemical agent on us out of a canister, led to the hospitalization of myself and 10 other students. And in response to this, the movement on campus begins to demand more accountability, more transparency from the university. We start organizing both political education events as well as democratic divestment referendums. We win every single one of those referendums, which demand that the university disclose its investments and then commit to a plan to divest from companies that are materially complicit in Israeli colonization and genocide. So as of the time of all of this last year, including through the encampments and Hinz Hall, we only had access to, I believe, 3% of Colombia's investment portfolio because they keep it effectively in a black box. They do not share it with students. We've submitted requests to the committee that is in charge of sustainable investment policy at Colombia. We've submitted requests to the administration. And so ultimately that became one of our core demands of disclose and divest, where because we can't even name all of the horrors that Colombia is complicit in because they refuse to tell us. But what we do know is companies like Boeing, which makes the bombs dropping on Gaza, companies like Google, which are actively complicit in the technological apartheid infrastructure and military and weapons technology that is being used, not just on Gaza, but across all of historic Palestine. And so we know about 6 companies that Colombia is actively invested in that were and are contributing to the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza and across historic Palestine. But for us to actually be able to demand complete divestment, we would need access to the complete list, which Colombia still to this day has refused to provide.
Tell me about your lawsuit.
Yeah, so the lawsuit is on behalf of myself and 2 other graduate students, all 3 of us who were targeted for our organizing on campus and retaliated against with disciplinary sanctions for being too outspoken or too active. Myself and one of the other plaintiffs, Aiden Parisi, were first suspended following a political education event that was hosted as part of Palestine Solidarity Month called Palestinian Resistance 101. And we were both suspended following this event without any evidence being provided against us, without any hearing, as is required by all of the written codes and university charter and statutes. Colombia threw those out, again, under public pressure, including from the House Committee on Education, to target us. And we were disposed of by the university, as so many other students have been before us and have been after us. And Aiden and I were both evicted from our apartments with 24 hours notice in violation of New York tenant law. And then following this...
This was campus residence?
We lived in leased dorms or leased apartments. We didn't live in dorms. So they all have the protections that New York State tenant law provides, which requires at minimum 30-day notice in order to begin eviction proceedings. And Colombia essentially tried to force us to self-evict, demanding that we leave our properties within 24 hours. And that was one of the first times that we actually saw the kind of beautiful community network come out to support students in the face of disciplinary sanctions, because these were some of the most severe sanctions that any individual student had faced at that point. There were five of us placed on this indefinite suspension, including an undergrad student who was immediately evicted from her dorm because of the lack of protections that students in dorms have over their housing. And so we had an amazing outpouring of support for eviction defense, where students were staying and sleeping in our apartments and staying outside the building in order to make sure if Columbia did send an eviction marshal that we would not be going quietly. And so I think that was one of the first kind of glimpses to me of how broad the base of support was on campus, not for us as individuals, but for what the retaliation against us represented, that this university would do anything to silence and repress students who are advocating for liberation, students that are advocating for the safety and rights of the Palestinian people on this campus, and that the student body would not take that line down, and neither would the broader community. And this was also a really pivotal kind of turning point where we began to build more relationships off campus to a variety of community organizations and collectives. And those were really critical and foundational relationships both on and off campus that laid the sort of bedrock for the Gaza Solidarity encampments, which were already in the planning. Plans for an escalation on campus had been in the works as early as January of 2024, was the first meeting about the need to escalate in our organizing tactics because Columbia was refusing any of the sanctioned tactics that we had tried. We had tried sanctioned protests with permits from the university. We had tried democratic referendum, which we overwhelmingly won across 8 schools, and yet Columbia ignored once again. We had tried tabling, we had tried political education events, but even our political education events were being repressed at this point. We were being suspended for merely sitting in a room and talking about Palestinian resistance. And so it was clear to us that Columbia was trying to completely erase any space on that campus for students to not only engage in these kinds of discussions, but to engage in our fundamentally protected right to academic freedom and protest on our campus. They wanted to tell us exactly when, where, how, and why we could protest. And one of the arguments that we have made all along is that that is no longer a protest. When the university or the state manufactures a space and a container for you to protest in, that is not protest, it is a performance. And we refused and continue to refuse to this day to engage in performance in the midst of a genocide and the massacre of our loved ones in Palestine.
And your litigation has been filed in which court? And who's representing you, if you can talk about that? And what are you seeking?
Yeah, in New York State Supreme Court. And we essentially, the lawsuit documents, it's over 65 pages, and it documents over 30 specific cases of Columbia violating different forms of contract law, negligent infliction of emotional harm, and physical harm. We talk about the skunk attack. We talk about the police that Columbia invited onto campus and unleashed upon us 2 different times, wherein one of those times I and other students were hospitalized as a result of the police violence in Hinds Hall. And we talk about the fact that Columbia essentially succumbed to external pressure. And ultimately, there are 10 causes of action in the suit. And what we're demanding is that Columbia reinstate us to our academic good standing, that scholarships are reinstated, that all of the credits that we had been actively in the process of accruing in the spring semester that were taken from us, which again did not only financial harm, but delayed all of our graduation timelines, that all of that is reversed and that we are given the ability to finish out those classes, return to campus, return to our housing, return our healthcare, our stipends, our scholarships. I also lost my campus job as a result of this, which was my sole source of income. So everything that Columbia took from us as a retaliatory move for our political activism and organizing on campus must be reinstated. And also, I think a really important part of this lawsuit that one of our lawyers has spoken to publicly is that it's not solely about us. It's very important for the three of us as individuals to be reinstated because Columbia knowingly took not just our education, but so many of our most basic rights in the form of healthcare, housing, and food away from us as a result of these sanctions. But that, to me, even more importantly, it is about what not just Columbia, but universities across the country are engaged in right now, which is violent suppression and repression of not just the Palestinian student movement for liberation, but any liberation struggle that threatens their bottom line, that threatens their legitimacy in the eyes of Congress, in the eyes of Donald Trump. These universities are cracking down in some of the most horrendous McCarthyite ways we have seen in decades, really since the 1968 student uprisings. And this lawsuit has the potential to set a precedent and show both Columbia, but also universities like Columbia, that if you try to retaliate against students for political activism, for academic freedom and their right to protest on campus, then you will be held accountable to the letter of the law, and that will come with measures that hopefully do not only impact our individual cases, but actually set a precedent for how these universities are expected to treat all students across the board in any political struggle on campus, and that our rights cannot just be disposed of, and neither can we when it is politically convenient or expedient to these universities.
And does the U.S. constitutionally guaranteed rights to free speech and assembly get mentioned in your lawsuit, therefore perhaps paving a path to the Supreme Court if that's where it goes?
So unfortunately, private institutions like Columbia are not actually required to abide by certain constitutionally protected rights, including First Amendment rights, are not guaranteed on a private university campus in the way that they are on a public university campus. What is guaranteed is everything that is in Columbia's university charter and statutes are contractual obligations between the university, between its administrators, and its students. That is a contractual obligation from the time that you begin your studies at the university. And so that is what we are alleging throughout this lawsuit are the contractual violations, is that Columbia and every university like it have provisions in their student code of conduct, in their charter and statutes, providing for the rights of students to freedom of assembly, to protest, to, in particular, academic freedom, to speak on issues. And Columbia writes this explicitly in their charter and statutes, that you have a right to engage in protest and engage in academic freedom, freedom of speech on campus, even the kind of speech that will make people extremely uncomfortable, even the kind of speech that people will viscerally dislike, even that is protected. And that is true of almost every university's code of conduct, yet all of them are flouting their own contractual obligations to their students. And I would say that the most relevant federal claim potentially that comes out of this lawsuit is the discrimination claim, the Title VI claim, which is that Columbia not only discriminated against me on the basis of my ethnicity as an Arab woman, but discriminated against all three of us in a form of actually reverse discrimination, whereby the safety viewpoints and rights of students supporting Israel, Zionist students on campus, were privileged over those of us who were seen as and who identify as anti-Zionist. And so Columbia itself and many universities like it right now are engaging in their own apartheid systems, in their own essentially kangaroo courts, which are their disciplinary processes, whereby a student who admitted to attacking us and hospitalizing 10 students with a chemical agent, whether he claims it was skunk spray or not, he admitted to attacking us. So Columbia knows that he had the intent to commit harm on other students, harm that led to 10 hospitalizations, and for myself and some other students, medical symptoms that continued for over 5 months. And yet that student, who was an Israeli soldier, was returned to campus in complete academic good standing after an initial suspension and was awarded $395,000 in a lawsuit. So not only was he returned to campus, he was financially compensated for attacking us. Whereas myself, Aiden, Brandon, and other students like us are facing indefinite suspension, immense emotional, physical, and financial harms from this university, and all for what? For protesting in the midst of a genocide.